Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron. I don't want to welcome Lynn Wilkins to the studio. Good morning.
Morena.
So there is a book, what do you call this, a booklet, a newsletter? No, it's not a newsletter. It's a publication.
Yes, I'd call it a collection of local writers' works.
Okay. It's called Backlit, and I'm interviewing you because I've interviewed a lot of the other writers and because I didn't know you wrote. So it was kind of like, that intrigued me as well. Like, there's Sarah Johnson, Bernadette Gavin, Wanda Barker, Meryn Tate, Matt Cambick, Deanna Wells. Honestly, I think I've interviewed all of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Which, I mean, and I'd be very happy to talk to them again, but I was intrigued by the fact that you were writing, because I know you as an accountant and as a musician. So, and you're not doing accountancy anymore.
No, I am retired.
Yeah, retired. But you've actually been writing your whole life.
Yeah, I have.
And in a big way?
Yes. Yeah. Professionally.
Yeah.
I did actually write a lot of technical manuals, and some of those are actually publications, or were, you know, back in the day when...
Have you got any technical manual writing in here?
No.
That would be really funny.
I think that would be quite boring. It's usually very, very specific to particular types of software and things like that. That's what most of it was about. And I wrote policy manuals for a few organisations, procedural manuals and that sort of thing. Also contributed to a textbook back in the 90s.
Those are all things that, like you say, you use the word boring, and if it's not the thing you want, then that is boring. You don't read it for recreation.
No.
But is there a skill to being able to do those things well?
Yes, there certainly is, because with technical writing, you've got to lead a person through from the beginning to the end of a process or a policy or whatever, and assume that they know nothing, but keep it engaging enough for the ones who know something to keep them reading so they don't assume they know everything, because you do want them to go from beginning to end. So really, I think one of the job descriptions given to me back in the 90s for one manual was, we don't want our IT people being hassled as much as they are. So I was trying to create something from the finance perspective to lead people through these processes so they didn't have to go and ask questions of the IT.
But people would still much rather ask someone than read something.
Yeah. But I think people like the fact that maybe they were just picking up a process once a month, and so it was there outlined for them, and we used to do summarised sort of checklists and things to help with that kind of stuff as well. So it's quite a specific skill, and not one that I've engaged in probably since the 90s.
Okay, so you might have forgotten how to do it.
No, I don't think so, but I think the need for it has changed, because everything's online now. You can Google, you can... you know, find online tools, and somebody's already written them for most of these things.
Yeah, and the best thing it used to be with the internet that the best things would rise to the surface.
Yes.
And that's what you'd find, and it would be really easy to follow. But I don't feel like that's the case anymore.
No, probably not so much, because I looked up a process for a website that I was working on recently, and I found about 6 different solutions for the problem I was having, and the one that actually worked was the 6th that I got the list.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's around the wrong order.
Yeah.
So your writing in here is creative writing? Is it all creative writing? Is that how you'd describe it?
Some of it is creative. In other words, for me, the word creative means it's come out of my brain with no... I won't say basis in fact or reality, because there is some of that, but it's really just come out of my head. But I did include an article in the publication, and that, while there is a creative process applied to that, that is actually based on facts and information, and that was me pursuing an interest, really.
So this is the one called From Minstrels to Music Media, The Industrialization of Music.
Yes, that's right.
And what's the takeaway from this, Lynn?
I explored the whole idea of industrialization in music in particular, because for my own musicality, if you like, there's some very interesting factoids that I was aware of, and that included the development of the flute, because I play the Irish flute unkeyed, partially keyed, and then I also play what we'd call the standard sort of orchestral flute, which is keyed with a Boehm system. And all of these things, you know, technically led me to explore how that keying system came up, what it meant in terms of mass production of instruments.
What is keying anyway when it comes to a flute?
Oh, well, there's all these little keys that cover holes for you that your fingers can't reach.
Yeah, I've seen them. So the little finger taps that thing and down the end it covers a hole. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So on the wooden flutes or Irish flutes, as they're often described, because they're used in that sort of genre, some of them have no keys at all, and you do need to be able to stretch your fingers quite a lot to reach the notes, but also you're limited as to the number of notes you can play. You can do what they call half-holing and things, but that's pretty hit and miss for some of us. And so the development of these other keying systems, it didn't just apply to the flute, of course. It was all sorts of wind instruments, but it was all part and parcel of that industrialization pathway that was taken, and then the process of mass producing certain instruments.
So they would have become much cheaper to produce.
Yes, yes.
And they would have had to have been crafted before that, like handcrafted.
Absolutely. And so when you look at some of the very old flutes, you can see how they have soldered or attached certain pieces, and each one would be slightly different, even if they're made by the same maker. But even things like solder and all that became part of the industrialization process.
So how did that change the music?
Yeah, my exploration was...
Didn't go there?
Well, it did, actually. It went through three parts. One was the manufacturing of instruments, and the accessibility that created. Another was the mass production of recorded music, because that really was a game changer. And, of course, here we are sitting in a radio station where recorded music is very much part of what happens. So in the past, the only way people could access music was live. So pre-industrialization, people would participate in music in some form, maybe out in the fields or in their church.
Yeah, so they didn't necessarily go and watch someone. They just sang or played themselves.
Yes, quite often. But then there were also things like you'd have a fiddler and a flute player playing for dances. Or you'd have... In a more wealthy sort of home, somebody come and play, maybe write a piece for the homeowner. That was kind of a thing that was done. O'Carolan's a very famous Irish composer who used to write pieces for his hosts.
Do those have to be flattering pieces?
Musically, they would be usually quite lovely in terms of O'Carolan's tunes, the names, I suppose, of the tunes could sometimes be a little interesting. So,
complimentary or not complimentary? Subtle,
yes.
Subtle comments about the family that they didn't know were being, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I actually think that's quite a significant shift that recorded music turned a lot of people into... from participants just into an audience?
Yes, and what it did was, of course, it made music accessible to many more people than previously, because you didn't have to have a piano in your home. I mean, at one stage, piano makers had made it a goal to have a piano in every middle-class home in somewhere like the States, for example. So, but, of course, that goal was unrealistic.
Apparently the music charts in those days were the number one song was the number one piece of sheet music that was sold.
Yes, exactly.
Which is an intriguing concept. Yeah,
well, and again, that's an example of that industrialization, because the ability to print that sheet music and distribute it across a whole country, where in people's living rooms or lounges or parlors or whatever, they were all standing around the piano singing the latest, you know, Broadway tune or Tin Pan Alley tune, because they had somebody had acquired the music and learned how to play it. So there was still quite an element of live music, even though that was going on. But at that same point, there was recorded music available to people as well, in much more old-fashioned sort of releases, such as Cylinders and the Shellac records.
The original stuff.
Yeah.
So, folks, we're actually talking about writing, believe it or not.
We've digressed.
We're not into music, not surprisingly, really. So one of Lynn's pieces in Backlit, the local publication of local authors, is about the industrialization of music. But there's also poems, and this Vancouver Skytrain, is that a poem, this piece?
I describe those pieces as vignettes. What happens is sometimes, especially when I'm traveling, there'll be a little snippet of something that's happened or that I've overheard someone talking about or something along those lines, and I will quickly write it down, and from there it may just stand on its own or it might grow a little bit. That one pretty much stood on its own when we got back from that particular train trip. I immediately wrote it all down as
well. You are originally from Canada, but it's a long time ago that you were based in Canada.
Yes, but we went over and visited my brother. He lives there.
Okay, right, so it's not from early years.
No, okay. That was 2018, I think, from memory.
Okay,
that's
quite recent, okay. Yeah. So I really liked it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read a line from it to give people a sense of the flavour. I guess I need to say that you're overhearing this conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, so the line I wanted to read was, yes, I was married once to an ugly woman. She was so, so ugly, but she had money.
And that was it, word for word.
That was it, word for word. Yeah. Yep. And then, but the piece, there's four paragraphs, and they can, that raw, it's not confrontational, but raw, real.
Yeah.
Real internal monologue that's come out into the world that continues through with that. Can you tell us about this?
Well, yeah.
I don't want to read the whole thing because I don't think I'll do it justice, but people should get hold of Backlit, which is, incidentally, in cafes. Will people find it in cafes and places like that?
Cafes, outside a couple of the real estate agents, property brokers and Baileys, and there's copies in the library, the old school, and, pretty much where you'd expect to find it, and it's free.
Yes.
So, yes, you should grab a copy and take it home and read it, pass it around,
So, yeah, Vancouver Skytrain.
Yeah.
What's the story?
So my husband and I were walking with a plan to get on the Skytrain and go into the centre of Vancouver from where we were staying, and these two men who were obviously alcoholics and possibly drug takers, who knows, but they were in a bit of a state. One of them made that comment as we passed. And so part of me went, are they saying something about me, or is this just me reading something into it that's not there?
Yeah.
And, so that comment, the one that you read out loud, that was what they said. And so we carried on walking and just ignored them, and they, gradually fell behind us and disappeared, so that was fine. But on the train, I was looking at the scarred landscape, because they had a lot of forest fires that year.
Oh, yeah.
It was quite an eye-opener to my husband and I to be there, and on some days the smoke was so thick it was like fog.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I've been to Vancouver, it's beautiful when it's not smoky.
Yeah. Well, they'd had, I think, a lot of lightning strikes and things like that to start these fires. So from the train, we could see these big scarred black and strips, you know, in the middle of the hills, and still smoking some of them as well. And it got me thinking about the mix between the comment that I'd heard, myself aging, you know,
yeah,
one of those things that you reflect on.
And that reflection is in here.
Yes. And then also, you know, Mother Nature being scarred and ravaged. So, yeah, somehow those concepts all just kind of merged into one in my mind when I wrote the vignette. And it's an interesting process because I think going from writing something that's very logical and process-driven, you know, as a technical manual, you have to kind of throw that out when you're writing something like this and let the thoughts just kind of mix themselves in your mind in whatever way they wish to fall. You kind of let the thoughts take you over, if you like. And that's what I think allows that creative process of bringing together some things that otherwise people might think as unrelated, but somehow you mix them all together into this piece. It's an interesting process.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I guess that worked because it's very real. I'm trying to think of the ways of describing it. It's very real. You haven't filtered anything.
No.
And you haven't tried to, like, polish anything or cover up to protect your own ego or other people's egos too. The looks of these two guys. I think that's that lack of, I don't want to say lack of polish because that implies you didn't work on it or anything, but it's a lack of making it shiny and nice, I think, or making yourself and your thoughts shiny and nice. It's very real, and I think that's very attractive, especially in this world where there's so much polish and superficiality.
Yeah. I think for me, superficial writing isn't who I am. I think there's a place for it, certainly. But for me, I like to shine the torch into the dark corner, maybe, you know?
Yeah.
And just see what's there. And so I think that piece is a demonstration of that. And also, I mean, pulling no punches, because why wouldn't you just present something as it is? I mean, to me, that's art in a sense. It's taking something that we all see, we all think, we all, you know, people will have heard comments like that before, I'm sure, from drunks and people who are just not very nice. But, you know, it's just kind of saying, well, this is real and this is how it affected me at the time. And bringing those other elements in, like I said, it just sort of opened my mind and let these things, these thoughts merge into something that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Folks, we're talking to Lynn Wilkins about Backlit, which is I never have quite the right words, a collection of writing from local authors. And how did this come about? I know there's been a lot of writer activity in Raglan this year, so.
Yes, there's several writers' groups and active things happening at the old school, for example. The Inkspillers, I was invited to join. We're a small group. Our focus is mainly on helping each other with the practical processes of publishing and moving forward with our writing. We're all established writers. I'd be the only one who hasn't got a current publication for sale yet. But
you're working on something?
That. Okay. Yes, I am.
All right.
Novel,
short stories?
No,
technical,
actually,
another technical manual, perhaps?
No, those technical manuals are long gone, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm just collecting some poems. I'm just going to start with that. But I have a few other projects in mind. One of them's research-based. And, I won't talk too much about that
that's all right.
Yet, just, but maybe another time.
A vague idea about what's coming down the line. So.
So anyway, we sort of focus on supporting each other through through our writing careers at a more at a professional level. And Matt Cambick, in particular of the group, was the one who drove along the idea of putting this collection together. He had examples that he had acquired from other writing groups and places around the world.
Okay,
and so we looked at the idea and we felt that for us it would be a way of showing the community just what we have here in terms of writing. And we decided that we would self-fund this. So this is completely self-funded. And show what could be done. And our hopes are to widen the scope for another publication in a, you know, make it an annual thing, but open to other writers in Raglan. And we're also exploring the idea of a junior publication as well.
Yeah.
So we're hoping that from this seed, you know, a strong tree will grow. And
now, while you've been saying that, I've just glanced at a picture, a photo. No, it's a not an actual photograph because there's a sheep in a spacecraft. Meron Tate.
Yes.
Sheep learning curve.
Oh, definitely worth a read. That is hilarious.
Right. She's good at, like, she's good at, like, writing funny.
Yes.
Writing comedy.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right. We'll have a look at that one later. So did anyone, like, you know all these people in here.
Yes.
Did anyone write something that surprised you that you weren't expecting from what you've seen of their other work?
Well, I'd have to say all of it was surprising in the sense that, for example, I know Sarah's work, Maren's work, Wanda's work through books that they have published, but it's quite different to put smaller pieces together for something like this. And so there were some really interesting surprises there. Oh, and I should mention Bernadette as well, because her book is an adventure, I guess, for want of a better way to describe it.
Autobiographical adventure.
Yeah, so yeah. I didn't know what to expect from her with what she was going to submit. So, everyone's work, actually.
It's a different format, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, I mean, Matt, for example, I've heard some of his songwriting. So the poetry was unexpected. And I think perhaps that might have flipped as well for me, because people are used to hearing my lyrics as against poetry.
Is there a difference between lyrics and poetry?
Yes and no. I mean,
thank you for that. Thank you for clarifying that.
Not an easy answer.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Generally, with lyrics, you are aiming for rhyme.
Yes.
Not always. I have been on a recording of songs in blank verse, written by someone else. But yes, generally, you're looking for a rhythm and a rhyme that in poetry you don't necessarily have to aim for.
Yeah.
In fact, poetry can be quite almost narrative, like a short story, but with the pauses maybe guided by where the lines begin and end in the poetry.
Yeah.
So it is quite different. So yes, it was quite interesting to read Matt's poems, for example, after listening to some of his songs. So,
and might you choose your words for lyrics also as to be part of the music as well? Like that word will sound good here.
Yeah, well, you actually have to be quite careful with lyrics. I don't know if you've ever come across that moment where you're perhaps actually reading the lyrics for the first time of a song that you know really well and have heard many, many times, and you suddenly go, is that what they're saying? Mm. Because your mind has constructed something else.
I've seen little things on, like on Facebook, where there'll be the sound of the singing, the sound of the song, and then they'll put the words up, and then they'll play it again with different words, and then they'll play it again with different words, and then they play it again with different words, like four or five times, and they all make sense when you read them. You think that's what you're hearing.
Yes.
So yeah, because it's sung, it's not always clear what it is.
Yes, that's right. And so sometimes I think particular care with how the words sound together with the notes is important in lyric writing because you can be misunderstood.
Does that bother you as a lyric writer? If someone comes up to you and I loved your lyric and it was wrong?
Yeah, I have kind of looked at certain lyrics of songs. I can't think of one at the moment, but I've kind of wondered at the time, why didn't they think about how that scanned and sounded when they recorded it, because to me the words sound like they're saying something completely different, and yet you could have perhaps just replaced one word with another. It would have scanned and rhymed and all of that, but you know, it would have made sense.
The worst case I heard about this is the song Louie Louie.
Yes.
Apparently apparently it was a very bad performance, the recording. The record company thought nothing was ever going to come of it. And then there was a guy on a radio station, maybe in Seattle, somewhere around there, who played every week. He'd play like the worst song of the week. And he played it, but people liked it. And they started ringing up and trying to find it. And the song ended up, in the end, it got to number two in the US. But no one could work out what the lyrics were. And teenage boys in schools were creating their own lyrics that were lewd, of course. But then the CIA got concerned that the lyrics were bad. And so they started investigating the band and investigating the songs.
Oh my goodness!
And this went on for like a couple of years, and they had to, and they had to like get a copy of the song. And they had to send it to one of their places across state. So, given that it was considered contraband, it had to go through this special postal service where something illegal could be taken across the state line. And like the whole thing spun wildly out of control. And all it was like quite a bad performance, and no one could understand what the singer was saying. So that's the funniest version of that I've ever heard of. It just, the song that should not have gone anywhere went everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that is the sort of thing I was describing, but I couldn't think of an example. But, yes, there's certainly lots of them around. I know they've played them on, comedy shows and things on television. Yeah.
That's a worst-case scenario, I think, having the CIA investigate your song.
Yeah.
Although it could be good for publicity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're talking about the Ink Spillers booklet? What's the word? I keep struggling with this.
I'm just calling it a publication.
Publication, there we go. It's A4 in size. It has a cover and white pages inside with black writing. And items are like short stories, poems, even shorter stories, and yours is a research-based article as well about industrialization of music.
Yeah,
and there's some pictures too, including the one with a sheep sticking out of a spacecraft, the Meron story. I don't understand yet. I'm going to have to read that now. And people can pick it up everywhere, and you might do it again next year.
Yes, that's the plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think we're done. That's good because it's 10 o'clock, time to go. Anything you want to add or anything we should have talked about that we didn't talk about?
Oh, I think we covered all sorts of things, Aaron. And as always, it's a pleasure talking to you and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no, nice to have you in the studio. Is this now the second or third interview I've done with you?
Oh, it's probably getting up there to the third, I'd say.
Different topics each time, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. All right, thanks, Lynn.